This podcast is sponsored by GoCD, an on-premise, open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. To learn more about GoCD, visit go.cd/infoq for a free download.
Welcome to the InfoQ podcast, a software engineering podcast brought to you by the same team behind InfoQ.com. InfoQ.com is a software engineering news site which aims to help progressive software development teams adopt new technologies. InfoQ are also the people behind the International Software Conference, QCon. For InfoQ Podcast, this is Robert Blumen. I'm here today at QCon San Francisco 2016 with Oliver Gould. Oliver is the CTO of Buoyant, where he leads open source development efforts. Prior to Buoyant, he was a staff infrastructure engineer at Twitter, where he was technical lead of observability, traffic, configuration, and coordination teams. Oliver, welcome to the InfoQ podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Would you like to tell the community anything more about yourself?
I have a wonderful five-year-old dog. It's 50 pounds and loves the beach, and that's about it.
Great. Oliver, you're going to be giving a talk at QCon this week called Freeing the Whale as part of the Architecting for Failure track. I'd like to talk with you today some themes around failure. I want to start out with just briefly, what are some of the more common things we're doing architecture and infrastructure level to prevent failures?
That's a good question. So as systems become more complex, and this isn't complex in the terms of the features they do and the number of people that have to be able to operate with them, we find we have much larger infrastructures with many more components. So where we were able to run things on one computer, now we have warehouse-sized computers. And that means that things are going to break because we have more components and more links between things and more opportunity for chaos.
We don't want something that we know is going to break to cause a failure because that's preventable. So how is that taken into account in architecture?
So I think there's a few approaches to this that all have to be used in conjunction. One I think is really important is stratification of separating concerns. At Twitter, we did this with projects like Mesos and Aurora, which simplify and abstract a bunch of the hardware operation concerns and operating system configurations. And then we layered that with a number of other features like Finagle, which manages the communication layer, with deploy tooling, with observability systems. And the end goal there is moving most of it out of the application so that application owners don't have to really think about all of these things every time they build a new service or a new feature, and the infrastructure can provide a redundant layered approach to providing reliability for the application.
Is stratification another word for isolation, or are those different concepts?
Isolation, I think, is can mean other things as well. Where stratification, I see it as separating layers of the stack and moving things down, where isolation can be kind of feature-wise or lateral isolation as well. So I always kind of come back to the OSI model of thinking about the physical layer down at the bottom and the application up top. And we have all of these layers in between, and we need to think about reliability and resilience differently at each of these levels.
So is it fair to say your approach then is for at each level that software at that layer and hardware at that layer will try to employ redundancy and failover and other strategies to cope with known or predictable component failures the next level down?
Right, is to kind of introduce each of these domains a different set of failure modes and operating modes and really have a layered approach to resiliency just in that way.
So people such as yourself have a ton of experience with failure, and you spend a lot of time thinking about things that could fail, and yet large, high-profile systems that a lot of people depend on fail anyway. Why is that?
Because it's hard. I mean, these systems can be quite large. When I started at Twitter, we were best known for the fail whale, which is kind of what my talk's about, is that Twitter was known to be a thing that was hard to run well. And we had to move more quickly, more reliably at the same time. We needed to add more engineers and more pieces of puzzle without having more whale time. And this requires both solving some social problems, in teaching people how to interact and giving them the right tools to operate safely, as well as technical solutions, giving them infrastructure pieces or automation that allows for automatic recovery or for kind of graceful degradation.
So you said things fail because it's hard. So what's an example of failure that you've experienced that you might look back and say, wow, I never would have thought of that set of things happening?
Yeah, one of my first production deploys out of college, we were developing a configuration management system that ran on a few hundred thousand nodes. And we actually did a fair amount of testing before deploy. Deploy took about a month of testing to get ready, and we did it in the lab. And then when we went live, we still would have big incidents where we'd lose whole data centers sometimes. And this wasn't, again, because we didn't test it. It was because it was hard to really know the full matrix of things we have to test. And so we actually found we had to invest a lot more in our response to these things rather than preventing them, because they were, given the complexity of the system and the diversity of the infrastructure, we couldn't enumerate every single failure we could anticipate. And so maybe on this point also, I think it's important to think about known unknowns versus unknown unknowns. In operations, we test all the things that we know we don't know, but in incidents, we find all of these things we didn't know we didn't know. And so I think capturing all of that out of the incident process is really important.
You used a term a moment ago that systems are complex. The conversation around this issue often introduces the idea of what are called complex systems, which have this property discussed of a lot of interacting components, and the number of combinations of things that could fail becomes this combinatorial number, which exceeds ability of the human mind to think of all the combinations or to test all of them. So is that your view, that most of these failures are not a single thing that went wrong, but multiple interacting things in a combination that wasn't anticipated?
I think those are the harder ones to think through, or the really complicated ones. There certainly are, single cause issues. Sometimes a backhoe goes through a fiber line. But I think there are rarely single solutions to these problems. We end up, solving these problems in a multitude of ways across multiple layers of the stack or multiple services across the stack.
Can you think of a failure you've experienced in which there were multiple causes interacting, of which any one of them would have not been catastrophic?
Well, okay, I can't speak too concretely about this incident, but we were once in an incident where we had a power outage. And we had redundant power, but what we didn't really understand is what happened when two power things went wrong, not next to each other, but kind of just separated far apart enough that failovers did not go well. In distributed systems, we frequently talk about cascading failures, but we don't usually think about that cascade starting at the very kind of physical electron level. And so these are things that are hard to test, where you test one power bank going down, you test two, but you don't test two in the right exact way, which causes cache misses, which causes the site to fail, and kind of ripple up the stack in ways that were basically untestable before that.
My own background, I've been a software engineer for many years and recently moved to DevOps. I found software people have a certain set of things they're very good at thinking about, and DevOps different set of things. To what extent is teamwork and collaboration important to understand the total risk picture of a system?
I think it's fundamental. I started at Twitter and in the ops team, and within a year or two, we moved to a much more DevOps model where service owners were on call and held the pagers for their own services. And it was the only way that we learned how to make the system better. If there wasn't a very tight feedback loop between the operational teams and the development teams, and hopefully combining those things as best we can, I think the socialization of lessons there is really important. And the more barriers there are to the communication, the worse things can get. So incident responses can be, if they're not structured well, can be very chaotic and high friction.
What is one story of feedback between and collaboration between those groups of different skill sets resulted in an improvement to your system?
Yeah, so when I was working on the observability team at Twitter, we initially launched on Cassandra. And this was actually, one team was working on a counter system in Cassandra, we were building a time series database, and we also had a Cassandra team which was doing a bunch of optimization in Cassandra. We spent probably a month or two testing it, battle hardening it, getting ready to go to production. And then as soon as we went to production, we had a number of performance problems that we really couldn't have foreseen. And they were because what we found out to be time irregularities, where we are measuring data minutely, and we found second level spikes that far exceeded our capacity. And so that was a combination of working both with the Cassandra teams, working with the team that had developed the counter system, as well as our own team, to really root cause this. And it took, it wasn't one incident where we root caused this all, it took, you know, months of several incidents where we got closer and closer to the underlying issues that were enabled us to fix them across the board.
Just now use the term root cause. In some of the reading around this, I've come across this idea of the myth of the root cause, which is the proposition that these outages in complex systems do not have a single cause. They tend to have multiple causes. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there are times when one thing happens, but it's rare. The more components you have, the more those interactions are where the problems are. And as I said before, I think it's very rare that there's a single solution to an issue. We almost always have a menu of solutions that varying costs that we have to employ after an incident.
Sure. And in relation to this collaborative process and iterative improvements, what should we learn from failure? Or what do you try to learn from when you're involved with an outage?
I always try to learn what I didn't know before the outage, uncovering the things I didn't know before, uncovering the unknown unknowns and making them known unknowns. It's frequently when you go to an incident, you don't even know what questions to ask. You're asking the wrong questions. And so as a team, we want to get better at asking the right questions because that ultimately is what reduces the time to recovery.
Can you think of a case you were involved with of an outage where you learned something from the process that enabled you to prevent that same type of outage from taking you down again?
Yeah, so there's one great example that we went through with Zookeeper and Finagle at Twitter. And this is related to the service discovery outages we had, which could be quite catastrophic for the system. So we initially started by just using Zookeeper as a source of truth for where I connect and send requests. And then we had some Zookeeper outages where it went down, and the clients, if they weren't well-conditioned, would lose all their state and fail. And so we started putting better caching into the clients there. And as we had caching in the clients, we got very confident in our robustness. And then we had another Zookeeper outage a few months later, and the entire system went down, the whole cluster. And things continued to serve well, and we thought we had ridden out the incident, we were ready to go. But then as we brought back the Zookeeper cluster, it was empty. There was no data in there. And this was kind of a whole blind spot we had in the system. We assumed that things would always be automatically populated immediately. And in this recovery phase, it was actually very slow to get data to recover. And we found that we had not been well conditioned for that at all. And so now we find in Finagle features like probation, which will not eject things just because they're not in service discovery anymore. And we started to think about the problem fundamentally differently. And we started to think about the end-to-end requirements for service discovery, and that this actually informs a load balancer, and that the end interface isn't just the service discovery interface.
There were states in the system then that weren't in your model of the states of the system.
Right, and in fact, I think we had the entire interface wrong. We weren't thinking about the right interface at the right level. And so a series of incidents there really changed the way we thought about the problem in a way that I couldn't have anticipated before.
It took more than one incident for you to really solve that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Each one gave you a piece of the story.
Yeah, and this is all, you know, many people talking about this together and learning this together, where getting the best voices in the room to kind of share different insights about these incidents from either prior jobs or from the current environment.
Organizationally, how do you go about learning from an incident? Do you advocate postmortems or other approaches?
I think it these are all tools that you have to use. These tools will not solve all of your problems. They're not silver bullets. But being part of an organization that doesn't do postmortems probably isn't learning very much, or isn't sharing the knowledge. That learning is being isolated. And so postmortems are great at socializing the changes or the incidents or the lessons of those incidents.
What do you want to come out of a postmortem?
Again, the list of new questions that we didn't ask when we went into this that we should have asked to start, I think that's, in my mind, the biggest one, the what didn't we know before we came here? As well as there's always a checklist of things you should be doing, and we always want to make sure that checklist is up to date. And I think being rigorous in a postmortem about updating these checklists is really important.
By checklist, do you mean more like updating run books for how people will respond, or do you mean series of action items that need to go into your software development of things that might need to be fixed or recoded?
Yeah, I think about this more from the process point of view, that there are various processes that you have, whether that's in testing or in deployment or in incident response, and those things always need to be adjusted continually. You don't ever lay out a perfect process for people. People are complex. And so we always have to refine that process in small ways that makes it easier for people to operate through.
Okay, now let's look at the other half of my question. Do you find coming out of a postmortem that there are either bugs or redesign or engineering work that needs to be done to fix issues that surfaced?
Oh yeah, that's always almost always the case. As I said, I think you come out with a menu of options and how you want to solve this, and each of those entries has a different cost. And there's probably some low-cost fixes that might be easier, but they may not be as broad in fix. But those things have to feed into your roadmap and to kind of, it's a process.
I was reading an article to prepare for this interview, and we'll link to this in the show notes. The author said, to avoid failure, we need experience with failure. This comes from having worked with systems that have failed, giving the ability to recognize what's going on and act on it. That sounds pretty reasonable, but it's a little bit discouraging because it means that we have to go through a lot of failures in order to prevent them. Do you agree with that view?
I think it's true, but I don't think it's true for a group. I think it's true for a group and not the individual. So people at Google have been dealing with incidents at large scales for years, and now we see a bunch of their open source technology come out that we can just use and stand on the shoulders of giants. Things like Zookeeper, for instance, are very hard to get right, and I'm sure had many failures initially, and now any of us can go download that and get distributed locking in a very reliable way. Yes, I agree with it, but I don't think it's as pessimistic that we all have to go through the lessons individually. I think we can share these lessons, and one of the best tools we have for that is open source software.
You are involved in an open source project which is trying to incorporate some of these lessons. Talk a little bit about that.
So a project I've been working on called Linkerd is an open source proxy built on Finagle. Finagle is Twitter's open source networking stack. Most people use Finagle for its programming model. But additionally, there's a number of operational lessons encoded into Finagle. Things like service discovery, load balancing, security, retries, timeouts, all of these things that are very hard and take a lot of time to refine in your organization, we shouldn't have to be able to solve over and over. We shouldn't have to solve over and over again. We should be able to use components that do this for us across languages and runtimes.
We could do a whole show, I'm sure, on this open source project, but talk about one feature you're especially proud of that Linkerd brings to the table that maybe is not out there in a lot of other open source systems.
Yeah, so one of the real motivating features of Linkerd and why we call it a linker is that it separates the idea of logical names from concrete names. So when I say a logical name, I might have a user service that serves a user's database. But when I call the user service, that might be a user service on my laptop or a user service in Europe or the staging user service, and that decision is contextual of where I'm deployed or even what requests are flowing through that. And so Linkerd employs this concept called delegation, which allows us on a per request way to decide where we bind that request. Do I bind that to the staging instance of the user service or the production instance of the user service? This is something that we've used to replace staging, canary, a whole swath of hard deployment work can be solved using delegation.
In deciding, would it look at only attributes of the request or larger context of what it knows about the entire world in deciding how to bind it?
It can be both. So we can add per request metadata that says, use this extra data to make the decision of where this goes. And we can also have centralized policy that influences generally where requests go and how failover occurs and how we weight requests across regions and things like that.
Is it pre-configured to use a limited set of strategies, or can the developer write a piece of code and upload it as a plugin that will decide how to use all the data to bind the request?
That's a great question. So by default, we bundle a few default strategies for routing HTTP requests. But this is very pluggable. You can just drop a jar on the class path and implement your own logic there, and it will just fit in the system. Furthermore, we also expose APIs, so you can change this policy at runtime via what we call NamerD, the namer system.
I want to pick up on a theme that you mentioned briefly earlier on, that we've established that you cannot totally prevent failures as much as you might try. We can get better at it over time, but we'll never eliminate failures. To what extent, then, should we be engineering toward avoidance of failure versus engineering toward speed to recovery? We accept that failure is inevitable, and we want to make them as short as possible.
I agree. I think we should bias heavily towards recovery. I think it's very hard, and in very rare cases do we need a system that never breaks. And as most of our websites are developing, or the systems we're implementing, it's much more important to be able to fix them quickly than to have something that is impenetrable.
What are some strategies for building systems that are fast to fix?
Systems that are easy to debug tend to be fast to fix. And so making sure you have visibility into the right parts of your system so that you can ask questions. And so this goes back to what I was saying before, of having the list of questions you want to ask going into the incident. The better you can answer those questions quickly, the better your incident response will be.
So do you mean, for example, you'll have a run book that says, if you see this, check A, check B, check C, look at this queue, look for file system error, something, a list of things you know by experience are the most important things that the on-call person should be investigating?
That, and also having the ability to drill further. So there's always a question of why, or what if, or could this be happening? And we always need the ability to kind of go one step further from where we started and ask more questions as we go through the incident.
So this is pointing toward having great logging metrics, dashboards, and all the other features that make it easy for the on-call person to tell what's going on.
Yeah, I think that is really important when a human has to be involved. And then the other side of this is closing the loop so that a human doesn't have to be involved in every breakage. So for instance, it's frequent that we just want to let systems fail and not fix them until it's convenient. And if we can design our system in a way that things can break at 3 a.m. without waking me up, I'm much happier. So I think that's another good goal.
Yeah, I think I would call that preventing an avoidable failure at the point where the system is an acceptable state to where you don't need a person, it's not a failure.
Right.
So can you give a example of something you're involved with where you didn't have the information that would have made it faster to get back up?
Yeah, I think that one of the things I always come back to is latency distributions. And if there's been times in our systems when we just don't instrument them properly in terms of knowing where we're spending time. In online systems, things very rarely go down hard, and they frequently get slow over time. And so being able to spot the places where we're getting slow and spot that it's happening for a very small fraction of requests now, but that percent grows over time, having the insight into those distributions has been really helpful in a number of production incidents I faced.
How about something where you did have the information, and had you not had it, the failure would have been much worse or much longer?
Yeah. Another system called Zipkin that we open sourced to Twitter is a tracing system. And this allows me to see the call graph between various components at runtime. We've been in incidents where we didn't even know all of our dependencies, where I include a new library in my application, I deploy, I have this new dependency that I didn't realize I was talking to, it didn't have on my graphs, didn't know to ask this question. And being able to go to a system like Zipkin that tells me, hey, you're sending a request over here right now is invaluable. Because as a service owner, I may not even know everything going on in my system. I need tools that can tell me more about than I need know to ask.
Yes, Oliver, you bring up a point that I also want to explore, the idea of that change is what often precipitates failure. We are constantly changing systems because we want to make them better, add new features, which includes introducing new dependencies. Is there anything we can do to manage change more intelligently without increasing our risk?
I think the answer may be no. I think we can make change safer by making its impact smaller. So for instance, when I go to production with something, showing it to a smaller percentage of users at first and being incremental in the way we do things can show us earlier that things will fail or without going to as wide an audience. But I think by nature, change is when we're always going to have problems. And I think it's going to be hard to totally squash that.
I want to come back to testing. You talked about you did a lot of testing of a system that you deployed, and yet it still had outages. So you must have not tested certain things either because you didn't think of it or because maybe they were not possible to test. What would you do differently knowing what you know now in that case?
Honestly, I think going to some level of production as soon as possible is the most important thing. It's going to be very hard, even with the smartest people in the room, to enumerate all of the things to test. Being incremental and, you know, to some extent agile to these things is really important, so that you're getting load in the system in the ways that you couldn't anticipate as quick as possible to get that feedback on how things have to improve.
So production load then is really different than any load you could simulate in a test environment.
There's no substitute for production load.
Yeah. What about deploying to production but only to a subset of users?
Yeah, I think that's a really good tool that you can employ to do this. Again, you're going to find things at the 99th percent user that you didn't see before then. But that's the kind of incrementalism that we need to be safe here.
Is that something you've used in past work experience?
Yeah, Twitter relies on feature flags heavily. There's a number of open source projects that address this as well. I think it's really important. And even Linkerd's routing logic allows you to do weighted rollouts, so I can send 1% of requests to a new instance before sending more to
that. A feature flag, something that enables you to deploy the code without enabling the feature, making deployment and feature separate steps. So what might you learn or what might go wrong after deployment, even when the feature's not been turned on?
Hopefully nothing. Hopefully we've isolated this properly so that nothing's going through it. Again, you're changing the software and we're adding dependencies, and there's always variability there that we have to worry about. But as we deploy and we want to be very incremental in turning that feature on, we hopefully isn't a fully Boolean decision and can be kind of partial as we crank that up.
You've been talking about incrementalism. There's some other techniques I've heard of and like to get some your view on them. This is the idea of game day or game planning, where you talk through if this went wrong, how would we respond, and you've at least planned what you're going to do in the case of outages. Is that something you find valuable?
Yeah, I think if you don't go into a big day without a plan, you're doomed. But I think as soon as you're there, the plan goes out the window as well, right? There's that great quote about that.
Yes. It's also been emphasized at the current QCon, some of the talks I've been to, that you have to test your failure cases. You have to unplug racks. unplug network cables, whatever it is that you think you've planned for, you don't know until you test it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree 100% with that. And I think it's, again, being very intelligent about what types of failures you're introducing. We want to do things like introduce some latency into some requests, introduce some errors into some portion of requests. Things can be quite black and white when you just tear down a rack, but having a NIC fail on the top of a rack switch might be a very different failure from that. And so those soft failures, I think, are the ones that are especially pernicious in a distributed system.
Could you tell a story where you've tested a failure and learned something new from that?
Yeah, actually, just recently, we've been testing our load balancing algorithms. So Linkerd has a variety of load balancing algorithms. At its simplest is round robin, where it just sends a request to every node in the cluster. As we go more complex, there are some different weighting rules we apply. I knew to expect that the more advanced load balancing algorithms would be better, but I was amazed by how much. And so we were doing some testing here where we take one node out of a 10-node cluster. Doing this with round robin pushed our success rate down to about 90%, which usually is a wake-me-up success rate. And just by changing the load balancing strategies we used here, we were able to push this up over 3 nines in most failure cases. And so this is, again, by just applying, you know, we know what our timeouts are. Here's a simple failure where one node falls out of a cluster. How is my system going to behave? And that's the sort of thing we should always be testing. It's just like, okay, this box goes away, or we introduce latency into the system. What happens when latency is here?
And how do you go about introducing latency into the system? How do you do that?
Yeah, so because my lens is through Linkerd, we can use Linkerd to do route through latency proxies, for instance, or to even inject latency in Linkerd itself. And so by having a managed communication layer that's outside of every application, we can use Linkerd as a way to route through a latency or route through a failure. Also, people employ techniques of using IP tables to inject latency and things like that.
So based on all your experience in this domain, are there one or two things you'd like to communicate to architects for making their systems more stable and more resilient?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we all love and embrace the Unix philosophy of have small components that do one thing well, I think we have to be really religious about that approach as we go into this distributed system world. So microservices are part of that. Microservices are not easy. But the goal there is to keep our applications as simple as possible so that really one small team can understand everything that's going to happen within that code base. And then apply that vertically as well as horizontally. So instead of, as well as having features be separated into services, also have the infrastructure separated so that teams and small teams can really own one part of those things very well.
Great. Albert Gould, thank you so much for speaking to the InfoQ podcast.
Thanks, Robert.